comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello, it is now 5 o'clock here at CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and you are listening to The Corridor, bringing you local and regional news from Kingston and the surrounding area, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie on Kingston City Council's review of residential air conditioning program options to support vulnerable residents.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. Tuesday's council meeting, following on the heels of a motion discussing snow clearing, Councillor Connie Glenn brought forward another weather-related motion, this time focused on preparing for extreme heat.
So I know it seems a little extreme, we're going from snow to heat, but here we are, Canadian to the core.
Councillor Glenn introduced a motion directing staff to report back to council on options for a residential air conditioning unit program aimed at supporting vulnerable residents with medical conditions in the city of Kingston. Staff will review best practices from cities such as Toronto and Hamilton, which have run programs providing free portable air conditioners to low-income residents with health-related conditions in the past. They will also consult with Southeast Public Health, which could help determine eligibility and manage funding distribution for residents to receive units. Glenn made the case for the motion, stressing the importance of preparation as summer temperatures continue to rise.
The reason for bringing this forward, I think we've made some significant steps forward in terms of providing cooling. However, we're still faced with individuals who suffer extreme circumstances in the heat. In 2018, a heat wave sent 13 people to the hospital. And this is something that we're likely to see continue if we don't provide help to those who cannot help themselves in this instance. So the motion is directed very specifically for people who cannot afford their own air conditioning units, for people who are challenged with medical conditions. Now what we're basically saying is, let's have staff and let's have public health go away and come back to us with a solid recommendation that would support the people most in need. So also coming out of our climate change adaptation plan, I note that there was mention of the vast increase in the number of days of 30 plus temperatures and that this is a general upward trajectory. So this is not an issue that is going away. I want to note a couple of other things there, too. July of 2024 was the warmest month on record so far. That wasn't that long ago. So we're not seeing a change in this overall pattern, and we know that it's only going to continue to get worse at the rate that we're seeing the change happen.
Heat response has been an ongoing conversation in council chambers. In winter 2025, council approved a motion establishing a maximum indoor temperature of 26 degrees Celsius for residential units equipped with air conditioning during the summer. However, that motion was not extended to units without air conditioning already installed, due to pushback from property owners and concerns about the legality of such a requirement. While landlords in Ontario are required to provide heating, there is currently no similar obligation for cooling.
One of the things I do want to say, because this was brought up, this is not asking landlords to provide this. We understand the challenges with trying to mandate that. We're not about to turn around and do that at this point. This is just saying for people who cannot do this for themselves, who are suffering from medical health conditions, let's put some sort of a solid program in place and support them because really, at the end of the day, what it's going to lead to is increased disability, increased numbers of people showing up at our ERs, and really this just speaks to the general well-being of our community, which I hope we're all concerned about.
The motion carried unanimously. Staff are expected to return to council with options by the end of April, a quick turnaround aimed at having a program in place for summer 2026. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Now over to CFRC's Henry Walker with a story by Michelle Dory Forestell, LJR reporter for The Kingstonist, about Napanee Town Council's aim to secure more resident input on the proposed HydroStore energy storage project.
Thank you, Dinah. Greater Napanee Council will seek additional input from nearby residents before deciding whether to support HydroStore's proposed Quinte Energy Storage Center, a move that could delay the decision by about a month. HydroStore presented the results of community consultation and preliminary technical studies for the project at Council's Tuesday, March 10, 2026 meeting at Town Hall. HydroStore is seeking a municipal support resolution from the town of Greater Napanee as part of its bid into a provincial procurement process run by the Independent Electricity System Operator, IESO. A municipal support resolution does not approve the project itself, but indicates whether the municipality supports the proposal moving forward through provincial procurement and regulatory review. First introduced to Council in June of 2023, the proposed facility would use a technology known as Advanced Compressed Air Energy Storage, ACAES. Surplus electricity from the grid would be used to compress air and store it in a sealed underground cavern several hundred meters below ground. When demand rises, the air would be released to drive turbines that generate electricity. HydroStore describes the system as a form of long-duration energy storage intended to improve grid reliability. The project is being developed in partnership with the Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte and will be located near Country Road 22, north of the Lennox Generating Station. HydroStore told Council that geological drilling completed last year confirmed the presence of suitable hard rock geology approximately 600 to 800 meters underground, a key requirement for the compressed air storage system. The company also summarized several technical studies conducted by independent consultants examining water sourcing, operational noise, traffic impacts, agricultural compatibility, and planning. According to the presentation, the facility would draw water from Lake Ontario through a pipeline rather than groundwater sources. The hydrogeological assessment concluded the project is not expected to affect local wells or groundwater systems. HydroStore told Council noise modeling shows the facility would comply with provincial environmental guidelines for rural areas, including a nighttime limit of 40 decibels at nearby homes, roughly comparable to the sound level of a quiet library or refrigerator hum. Traffic studies similarly concluded that nearby intersections would continue to operate with minimal delays, including during peak construction periods. HydroStore said the project would be located on a roughly 178-acre parcel with an expected finished footprint of about 80 to 90 acres. The facility would also include a surface reservoir estimated at between 20 and 25 acres. During the presentation, HydroStore also outlined several potential economic and community benefits associated with the project. Company representatives said construction of the facility could create approximately 670 jobs during the construction phase and generate more than $1 billion in economic activity. Once operational, the facility is expected to employ about 40 people. HydroStore also told Council the project would rely heavily on domestic labor and Canadian supply chains, which the company said would support economic activity in the region. The company said it also intends to provide community benefit payments to the municipality and work with the Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte on local employment initiatives. HydroStore also described community outreach conducted late last year, including door-to-door kitchen table discussions with residents near the project site and a public open house. According to the company, representatives knocked on 66 doors in the surrounding area and held conversations with more than 30 residents. Councillor Mike Schenk said he would like the town to conduct its own outreach with nearby residents before Council considers a municipal support resolution. Schenk said he would want to ensure residents in the area have an opportunity to raise concerns before Council makes a decision. If I have to live beside the power generation that you're doing here for 50 plus years, I'd like to have an extra month taken and ask, do you have my say? Shent told the meeting. I don't want to get to the 11th hour and then a lot of residents come up and say, hey, there's no way I want this near me. Town staff said conducting additional outreach would likely mean about a month's delay in the timeline for bringing a report on the municipal support resolution back to council. The Hydrostore representatives indicated that they hoped council might consider the resolution in April. Staff said that if additional consultation is undertaken, the report could return to the council in May or early June. Councillor Angela Hicks noted that if council proceeds with additional outreach, the process should have a clear timeline. I think there should be a time limit on the survey, Hicks said, noting the project has already been discussed by council multiple times and that Hydrostore has previously conducted public consultation, including an open house she described as informative. In defense of the proponents, they're trying to run a business, Hicks said. People aren't investing millions of dollars if it looks like we can't get our collective stuff together. Hydrostore told council it understood the request for further engagement, but noted the company is working toward a provincial procurement deadline later this year. We definitely want council to take the necessary steps they need to get comfortable, said Hydrostore Vice President of Business Development, Shahir Aziz. Adding the company would be willing to participate in additional community engagement if requested. Council ultimately voted to receive the presentation and direct staff to prepare a report on the proposed municipal support resolution, including conducting additional outreach with residents near the project site. Town staff said conducting additional outreach would likely delay the report on the proposed municipal support resolution by about a month, meaning it could return to council in May or early June. If approved, the resolution would allow Hydrostore to include municipal support in its proposal to the IESO, which the company hopes to submit thereafter. Meeting of the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee can be viewed virtually or watched afterwards on the Napanee Town Council YouTube channel or attended in person in council chambers at Napanee Town Hall, 124 John Street. Further information about council meetings, including agendas and reports, is available on the town's Civic Web portal.
Thank you to Henry and Michelle Dory Forstall of the Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Brenda Little, LGI reporter for CJPE County FM in Picton, about a new provincial grant that will help Prince Edward County Fire and Rescue to purchase cancer prevention equipment for firefighters.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM news 5 days a week, six times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
The Prince Edward County Fire and Rescue recently received a fire protection grant of just over $164,000 from the Ontario government as support for firefighter health and safety. As new statistics emerge, cancer in firefighters is a hot topic, and Ontario is helping to reduce the incidence by giving grants for cancer prevention equipment. Interim Deputy Chief Patrick Howe took me on a tour of the Picton Fire Station, where he showcased some of the new equipment purchased with the grant money. Deputy Chief Howe tells us more. Pat, the fire department recently received quite a bit of money to help with improving equipment. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, we were lucky to receive the fire protection grant for 2025-2026. Prince Edward County received $164,450 to invest in cancer prevention equipment for our firefighters.
And is that a problem with firefighters, cancer?
That's an emerging issue that we're all paying very close attention to. WSIB has recognized a selection of cancers in their presumptive legislation. They realize that firefighters are exposed to carcinogens through the course of their work, and it's top of mind for all of us right now.
What type of cancers are the most prevalent?
Prostate cancer is a big one.
Yeah, throat cancer, prostate cancer are two of the big ones. Bladder cancer, another one.
Wow, I'm surprised with the prostate cancer.
Yeah, when we talk about routes of entry, and so under your armpits, in your neck, and in your groin are areas where your body absorbs things more readily. And so that material is
present and available when we're working in the fire scene. So,
wow.
Mm-hmm. And part of the fire protection grant was focused on respiratory protection. So some of the things I'll show you today focus on our airways and the what we do to manage clean air for our firefighters. Part of our grant this year is to purchase another industrial decontamination machine. So this is the machine we see here on the left. Looks like a very large industrial dishwasher. And it is a tool we use to clean our hard goods after a fire. So if you think about our SCBA, our helmets, our boots, those sorts of things, prior to having equipment like this, we would go back to the hall and with a bucket of soapy water and a brush, we would scrub them the way best we can. And visually they looked clean, but you'd be astonished once the cycle of this industrial decon machine goes through how dirty the water is, even on a pack that you thought was clean. So that's a big investment for us. We purchased one of these units last year with the grant money we received from the provincial government. So we're buying another unit this year to go in our Consicon hall. And that allows us to serve the northern fire halls a little bit easier. You can imagine if we had a fire in Consicon or in Kerry Place, right now they'd have to bring all that equipment back to Picton to be washed. There's quite a drive there. It takes some time to wash the equipment.
And then if there's another fire,
exactly.
People have to go back out.
And so one of the things we learned when we purchased this machine is it takes time to dry and wash items. And if you've got firefighter equipment out of service for drying and washing, there's a bit of anxiety around what happens if we have another call. So another item we're purchasing with the grant this year is spare SCBA cylinders, spare helmets, and spare gloves, so that when a firefighter comes in with their dirty equipment, we can issue them loaner gear right away. We also have a selection of loaner bunker gear coats and pants for them to use. And so for the 12 or 24 hours that their routine gear is out of service, they can be wearing our loaner gear. And when their frontline gear is ready, they can come back and exchange again. The decon process is really important, but it does come with some restrictions in terms of gear being wet afterwards. And you can't air dry, or you can't dry them with heat. You have to use air dry. So it does take a little bit longer to dry the equipment than you'd expect. So you'll see out in the hall, we do have some purpose-built gear drying racks, but it does take some time. So this extra PPE is going to help us get our firefighters back into service right away. The other thing we're purchasing with the grant is another sink system like this. So this is a really good initial decontamination process. We'll bring the dirty equipment in here and we'll give it a rinse down and a scrub with the equipment that we've got in this stainless steel sink before we put it into the industrial washer. That allows us to keep the filters clean and allows us a little bit more life in our equipment. We were talking about respiratory protection earlier. So another big investment we made with our grant this year is a new quantitative fit testing machine. So we use this machine to test the fit of our face piece to make sure that the positive pressure is coming out and we're able to maintain a clean air environment for our firefighters. So we do this testing with all of our firefighters every year. They come in, they put a mask on, there's some appliances that connect to this medical device, and we've got a documented record that the fit of their face piece is appropriate for the jobs they're doing. So we're excited to have this new equipment here. We're also purchasing the remainder of the face pieces we need to ensure that all of our firefighters have a personally issued face piece. Previously, we would have a stock of face pieces in our rescue van that were communal. When you needed one, you'd grab one off the shelf and you'd use it. And then when you were done, you would clean it and put it back into service. You know, COVID taught us a lot of things about personal protective equipment and contamination across different people. And so it's, for us, really important to ensure that all of our firefighters have access to a personally issued face piece. We're also purchasing a selection of new helmets. We talked earlier about how downtime for cleaning. And so we're going to have a stock of compliant and in-date helmets available for loaning. When people's equipment is being washed. And then new gloves, a stock of new gloves for the same reason. Your gloves are wet, they're going to be wet for a day or two. And also the flash hoods, the hoods that we wear over our head to make sure that the contaminants and the heat don't affect us inside of our gear rooms. Yeah, so this fire protection grant has been a huge leap forward for our cancer prevention and our respiratory protection program. And it wouldn't have been possible without the support of the provincial government. So we're really grateful for this fire protection grant, the funding last year, this year, and next year.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
And thank you to Brenda DeLittle for that story. Up next, we have Juliana Gonsalves reading a story by Keith Dempsey, LJR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, on the Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands review of support for the Lyndhurst Turkey Fair.
Thank you, Dinah. Council of the Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands has directed staff to prepare a report examining potential municipal support for the long-running Lyndhurst Turkey Fair following concerns raised by event organizers. During Monday's council meeting in Lansdowne, councillors unanimously approved a motion requesting staff bring forward a report to a future committee of the whole meeting addressing issues raised during a recent delegation about the fair. The motion, moved by Councillor Angela Kelman and seconded by Deputy Mayor Terry Foti, asked staff to review several matters tied to the event, including the use of public spaces, assistance with road closures and barriers, bylaw and policing support, public awareness around property boundaries, and enforcement of special event permits. The direction follows a delegation last week from Barb Bajima, a director with Lyndhurst Events, Arts and Fairs, the volunteer group that organizes the annual festival in the village of Lyndhurst. Bajima told the council the event, which has been a fixture in the community for more than 3 decades, has faced increasing pushback from a small number of residents, raising questions among organizers about its long-term viability. "We do not want to see it disappear," Bajima said during the delegation. "It has been a staple in the community for over 30 years. It brings in a huge amount of people, businesses, and interest into the community of the small village of Lyndhurst, but also the surrounding area as well. The fair draws thousands of visitors annually and is held directly on the village's residential streets, a setting organizers say is central to its appeal. Moving the event outside the village is not being considered," Bajima said. "It'd die," she told the council, explaining that walking through the streets of Lyndhurst is part of the fair's unique character. "It's a beautiful little village." Unlike some other communities in the township, Lyndhurst does not have a dedicated fairground or large public venue capable of hosting the event. As a result, the festival relies heavily on street closures and cooperation from local residents. Bajima said the vast majority of the community supports the event. "I'd say probably 99.9% of the residents of Lyndhurst are in support," she said, adding that organizers are hoping to work with the township to address concerns raised by the small number of opponents. Councillor Monique Antoine Hartley suggested the township could help educate residents about bylaws and property boundaries, potentially through mailers or additional communication. She noted township staffers are already present during the event and wondered whether bylaw staff could also attend. "I see it personally more as an education thing rather than an enforcement thing," Antoine Hartley said. Bajima agreed, saying the goal is collaboration rather than enforcement. "Having bylaw officers on scene would be a last-case scenario," she said, adding that organizers would prefer the focus remain on education and assistance from the township. Foti also voiced support for the fair, describing it as an important community tradition. "The focus should be on the 99% who support the fair," he said, while noting the township would likely have limited appetite for additional policing resources given the presence of the Ontario Provincial Police nearby. Township staff is expected to report back to council with recommendations at a future committee of the whole meeting.
Thank you, Juliana. Coming up now is Ted Evans, LJI reporter for CJAI Amherst Island Radio, about the town of Greater Napanee's decision to move forward with a major reconstruction project for 2 streets in Napanee.
The town of Greater Napanee and Lennox and Addington County will be going ahead with the reconstruction of Center Street and Isabella Street in Napanee. As part of a successful joint application this year, the town and county received funding under the Municipal Housing Infrastructure Program Health and Safety Water Stream. The town expects to receive funding covering up to 73% of the project's estimated total cost of just over $10.5 million. As part of this project, staff plan to replace all water infrastructure on Center Street and Isabella Street. The project will also include new asphalt, curbs, sidewalks, and traffic lights as required. This includes installing approximately 600 meters of trunk water main, along with valves, fire hydrants, and services on Center Street between Dundas Street and Isabella Street, as well as 250 meters of similar works on Isabella Street between Center Street and West Street. The project will also replace 600 meters of wastewater main and associated maintenance holes and services on Center Street, as well as 175 meters on Isabella Street. 690 meters of stormwater main, maintenance holes, and catch basins will be replaced on Center Street between Dundas Street and Isabella Street as well. Engineering work is expected to be completed in 2026 with the intent of releasing the project for contractor bidding later this year. Construction is anticipated to occur over 2 construction seasons beginning in early 2027. Additional project information information will be presented to council later this year, providing council with the opportunity to consider the proposed approach and budget, and then later to make a decision on the construction contract award. Christy Kelly, Director of Environmental Services, Growth and Infrastructure Services with the Town of Greater Napanee, speaks about the project's timeline.
With this, we're hoping to move forward as part of the town and utilities budgets for 2026 with engineering and hoping to break ground in 2027. Likely will be a phased project over 2 years, but we'll work with the engineers and the contractors when we get to that time to determine the phasing and rerouting and that sort of thing.
Kelly explains some of the work staff has done and what they'll be doing moving forward.
We have just started some engineering work. There was a little bit prior to the funding application, but this year's budget allowed us to, the 2026 budget will allow us to move forward and complete the engineering for the project. And with most of our procurement processes, this will be a public a tender allowing applicants to determine the successful contractor for the project.
Michael Nobes, General Manager of Growth and Expansion with the Town of Greater Napanee, talks about the county's plans for new traffic lights.
The county has confirmed with us that their intention is to build in traffic lights where the pedestrian crossing is currently, replace that. That's an interim measure, and the lights would be installed as a permanent fixture through this project specifically.
Councillor Michael Shank noted his concerns about the disruption of traffic on Centre Street.
I have a hard enough time, you know, you have a little bit of a rush hour now, and when you start tearing up Centre Street, how are you going to bypass the volume of traffic to get south? All I'm saying is, how does the average Joe go down Centre Street when Centre Street is no longer there for a year or 2 years? I can see Centre Street in 15 or 20 years' time, it's going to be backed up immensely. So there's got to be an alternative route, because the only reason why, because you look at the city of Kingston, if I want to get to the other side, or, you know what I mean, at our past RMC, and thank goodness they put the bridge in when they did, because what it's done. But I can see that same problem happening here.
Nobes noted that traffic planning is a high priority for staff.
That is the ultimate question on our minds at this moment in time, but there's going to need to be very careful traffic planning to go along with that. We have a substantial amount of time to plan that out, but that is the number one question on our minds right now, and with the county too, is how are we going to accommodate that traffic flow and lessen the burden as much as possible on residential areas east and west of Centre Street.
Nobes went on to explain that upcoming county plans may help shape the future of roadways in Napanee.
When EA was done for the, call it the Northwest urban area, where future collector order roads are planned that are going to be under the jurisdiction of the county. But the county is also very soon going to be presenting, county staff will be presenting to county council the county transportation master plan update, which will look into considerations such as that.
Nobes noted the possibility of widening the area beside the street.
There's no intention on Centre Street to expand the limits of the road right of way, the ownership, because it's almost building wall to building wall. There's really no room there. But there is the opportunity to look at overall lane widths, and therefore that would open up more room for sidewalk width. We would need to consider existing utilities that are in there and relocating them to get them out of the way of the sidewalk. There's a lot that would need to go into it, but both vehicular and pedestrian movement is going to be top of mind in the design efforts that would be underway very shortly.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
And thank you to Ted Evans for that story, and also a thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region. And tonight's forecast for Tuesday, March 17th, we'll have cloudy periods with a 30% chance of flurries with a low minus 11. On Wednesday, we'll see a mix of sun and cloud with a high minus 2 and cloudy with a low minus 4 on Wednesday night. Thursday, we'll see 60% chance of flurries or rain showers with a high plus 3 and cloudy periods overnight with a low minus 3. And on Friday, we may see some snow with a high plus 2 and cloudy skies with a 40% chance of flurries on Friday night and a low minus 3. And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us.
When I was a child, Timonides, I had a secret fear that night would come and would never end. That we would live out our lives in total darkness. It was a small fear then.
Dark Side of the Tune has returned, and now at an even darker time spot. Tune in on Thursdays at 9 p.m. to get your dose of alternative music, including but not limited to metal, grunge, goth, and more. Hope to see you there. Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all of the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Chris Greencorn, who's doing a PhD in history under the supervision of Dr. Lisa Pozzoli. Welcome to Grad Chat, Chris.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I am also in history, so I'm very excited to talk today about your project. But before we dive into your research, can you tell us a little bit about your journey to this point and what attracted you to Queen's?
Sure, yeah. It's been sort of circular. I've come in and out of grad school a couple of times. I did my undergrad in Nova Scotia at St. Francis Xavier University, St. of X, in the history department. But I started there in the music faculty. There's a jazz studies program at St. of X. I didn't do especially well. I dropped out into general arts, but it ended up being my minor, essentially. I actually intended to come to Queen's for my master's, and that would have been in 2016. And for various reasons, I didn't. I chose to go to the University of Toronto and did a master's in the music faculty there in ethnomusicology, which is like the cultural studies, cultural anthropology of music. I took some time off in the middle. I came back. I got caught up in COVID, so it took some extra time to complete, and then afterwards, and then finally, when I decided I was ready to do a PhD, this would have been in 2021, coming up to the 2022 year, one of the main things that I considered was that in the time since I had considered Queen's before, one of the professors from the history department, whom I knew from my time there, this is Lisa Pozzoli, had joined the faculty here. So I reached out to Lisa, and she was super excited about it, as was I. And that pretty much sealed the deal. Yeah, so there's been a lot of in and out, but I am here and happy to be here.
Oh, no, that's great. And I will say for everyone listening, I am quite biased as Lisa Pozzoli was on my committee, and I think she's wonderful as well. So,
yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you and Lisa were able to reconnect and that you've been here since. So your research is titled Race and Authenticity in Helen Creighton's Collection of Nova Scotian Folk Culture. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that means?
Right. So to begin with, I suppose Helen Creighton was a folklorist, among other things, in Nova Scotia. She was born in 1899 and lived till 1989, so quite a long life. And even today really is the authority on Nova Scotian folk culture. She spent more than 40 years basically crisscrossing Nova Scotia and into New Brunswick and PEI, down the highways and byways in little villages, collecting folk songs, folk tales, superstitions, dances sometimes, like folk dances, and publishing that material, essentially. She started out as a journalist, more or less, on the radio, actually, in Halifax. Yeah, there's a brand new radio station there, like a CBC or CRBC affiliate at the time, in about 1926, 27. And she was looking for material, basically, like kind of local color, local interest material, which then led into this lifelong career in basically defining what folk music and other folk culture was in Nova Scotia. And so she was part of a broader movement towards that sort of thing that began maybe, you know, 70 years earlier. There was a school of folklorists, originally English scholars, but then more formally folklorists at Harvard and some in the UK as well. And she sort of sat between them in terms of her approach. And so, yes, so Helen Creighton is sort of the buck stops with her in terms of what folk culture is. I come to it as someone who grew up in the middle of a folk music festival, which is a funny place to grow up in the middle of, but my parents started a folk music festival when I was a kid in my hometown. And so, yeah, basically my whole life have been directly involved in these sorts of definitions, like, you know, what is folk music? Who or what is appropriate on a folk music stage? Those sorts of, like, the boundaries of a genre, lots of unspoken or implicit sorts of, you know, definitions, shibboleths, like taboos even, but they are very much there. So yeah, on one level, I come to it from sort of a practical, like engaged, public-facing position. But then also I come to it as a musician and someone who's studied music academically, this ethnomusicology degree I told you about a moment ago, thinking about music in society, music in culture. How do these definitions or taboos work? You know, what is the work that they do in the world? What do they include? What do they exclude? And, you know, as I was in the middle of my master's program, a new, well, archival recording project was released in part by the Helen Creighton Folklore Society, which sort of preserves her legacy in the public sphere, alongside the Black Cultural Center of Nova Scotia, which is a museum, essentially, but also the organization around that. They released an archival recording collection of songs that Helen Creighton recorded in African Nova Scotian communities, of which there were many. The way that that material was introduced, talked about in the liner notes and sort of the literature around it, it piqued my interest. There was essentially the explanation was Helen Creighton was very much a product of her time and, you know, brought her own prejudices to this work. But nonetheless, aren't we all so much richer for her having done that work? Which didn't quite sit right with me. You know, it didn't exactly answer what the prejudices were. It acknowledged that they were there, but didn't dig any deeper. And basically, I went to the archives to find out. I was living in Halifax at the time. Public archives, Nova Scotia Archives, was right down the street on the Dalhousie campus. So yeah, I got to work digging through the files, Helen Creighton's files, and that's led me led me here. Yeah,
it sounds like Creighton's work, well, it spans decades, and it's and it's been, it sounds like, quite well preserved by different organizations, the society, and maybe more than other folks have been. And you mentioned a little bit about liner notes, but what are some of the other types of sources or methods that you are working with to examine her kind of body of work and the communities, you know, which interact via her recordings or via Creighton's views on those?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that in terms of, like, you know, historical sources, the quantity and quality even of what has been preserved of Helen Creighton's working and personal life is really unusual. It's not, even for someone who lived through much of the 20th century, it's quite uncommon to have that amount of material to work with. And there are two reasons for that. One is that she kept practically everything, and in part because she didn't have an institutional sort of affiliation. She did her work mostly on her own. She worked with the National Museum, what's today the Canadian Museum of History, in Ottawa for a while, well, for 20 years, but, you know, didn't have a university affiliation or didn't, you know, work in government as such. You know, she was a contractor, basically. So her own collection was her way of establishing and maintaining her own legitimacy, basically. Mm-hmm. So she kept everything, all the correspondence with the leading figures in the field and many smaller, you know, less consequential people, recordings, photographs, the textual manuscript document collections that we as historians tend to focus on. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you know, that's split into her sort of research material, but also personal collections. Mm. There's a whole series of diaries as well, which mainly served her to document her collecting, but also sort of personal information is mixed within, right? Like she went to have lunch with somebody here and then, you know, got her recording machine fixed at the local shop, picked it up, and then headed off into the, like, into the field where she stayed that night. She got a haircut the next day. You know, like, it is her personal life and her professional life are very much tied up together. Mm-hmm. And, like, of course they are. The personal is political, but it's also, like, she was personally invested in this. So the collection itself is really striking and unusual. And it's also, because she is so important in the sort of public image of Nova Scotian culture, the archives in Halifax, this is kind of like a crown jewel of their collection, right? They've got, not only is it practically all there, but they've invested a lot of money in making it accessible, right? Mm-hmm. So much of the collection is available online, including the recordings, the photographs.
Wow.
Some of the textual material is still not digitized, and I don't know that it ever will be. Mm-hmm. And of course, like, there are various reasons for that, but the collection itself sort of shapes what it is I'm doing because it is so unusual and important.
It sounds very, very rich, and and like, there's so many potential avenues for you to take this, but you mentioned that Creighton's recording of Black Nova Scotians' folk culture and music initially piqued your interest. Yeah. So how do race and folk culture intersect? And it, it sounds like that's what drew you in initially. Yes. So how does that intersect in your work?
Yeah. So deeply, deeply interested in how those two ideas, you know, race as an ideology and folk, you know, expressed through folk culture, folk music, folk art, as another sort of ideology, resemble one another essentially, but also intersect in a specific way with these folk culture collectors. And one really doesn't need to look very hard to find ways that they do. It just, even in the sorts of arguments that are put forward in their published collections or their letters back and forth to one another, the way that we might refer to culture or ethnicity or these sorts of terms today in the 1920s or earlier even, in fact, up probably until the Second World War, were expressed in terms of race. And yes, it's abundantly clear. This isn't really a radical argument if you look at the sources. Folk culture as well, also expressed in terms of race. And they both deal with the sort of essence of a group of people, right? Race, it's often expressed in terms of, like, race is biological and ethnicity is more cultural or social. I'm not sure that I agree with that distinction, but race is a concept which traffics in sort of essences of people, you know, what is fundamentally basically true about a group of people, usually as defined by, like, a phenotypical, their appearance, physical characteristics. But as well, like, race in the period was used much the same way as we would use nation or nationality as well. So all of these concepts, race, nationality, ethnicity, culture, they're deeply, deeply imbricated, you know, layered on top of one another, intersecting. And folk culture, at least in the way that Helen Creighton and her sort of colleagues or contemporaries used it, supported this kind of national identity. You know, it also represents a sort of fundamental essence of a culture, more through culture in the sense that we would think of like art and music and not a group of people in the sociological definition, but culture as high culture, as the arts. They are aligned in a very specific way. Now, where I'm interested specifically is the ways that racialized groups, minoritized racialized groups, are included or excluded in this canon of what is Nova Scotian for Creighton. So Nova Scotia is itself an interesting case study for several reasons. It was in the grand scope of Canadian, you know, pre-Confederation quote-unquote Canadian colonial history, mm-hmm. quite a cosmopolitan place. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people from a lot of different places coming in and out. Prior to the 1960s, it had the largest African-Canadian population, both in relative and absolute terms, mm-hmm. So as a percentage of the population, and also in just sort of blunt numbers. And it is also the case that essentially one Indigenous group, one First Nation, the Mi'kmaq, the Nova Scotia is within the traditional territory mm-hmm. of the Mi'kmaq. So in both cases, it's distinct from many of the other colonies and then later provinces mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in demographic terms, without even considering the various European settler groups who mixed and mingled in Nova Scotia as both colony and province. British in its various forms, so the nations which make up mm-hmm. the UK, but also a variety of other European groups, most distinctly Acadians, mm-hmm. Who were the descendants of some early French settlers, the Scottish Gaelic immigrants primarily to Cape Breton and the northeastern part of Nova Scotia, and then also some German mm-hmm. immigrants in the Lunenburg County area. So some really distinct groups, kind of a constellation of groups that Creighton, among others, was interested in establishing sort of a hierarchy of, in terms of what was most representative of Nova Scotia mm-hmm. In historical perspective, but also in the present. My dissertation is exploring each of these groups, the settlers, the African Nova Scotians, and Mi'kmaq distinctly, because the way that folk and race are interconnected differs between them in sort of consequential ways. This shows up mostly in the context of authenticity. As you mentioned in the question, what was authentic expression, folkloric expression within one of these groups? Where authenticity comes into the equation amongst each of these groups, for the settlers, for example, the foreignness of the material, the fact that it had come from somewhere else, Europe primarily, was what didn't act counter to their authenticity. In fact, it bolstered their authenticity in the opinion of Creighton and others like them. The Britishness in particular of what were called child ballads, like a canon of a few hundred traditional English and Scottish ballads, the fact that they had shown up in Nova Scotia was perfect, you know. That reiterated a kind of position about the Britishness of Nova Scotia. So their authenticity depended on a certain foreignness to the specific geographical context. This was inverted in several ways for Black African Nova Scotians and for the Mi'kmaq. So, you know, African Nova Scotians, by definition, had also come from somewhere else. There were both free and enslaved people of African descent in Nova Scotia from early on in the history of the colony. And by Creighton's time, a large population, I mean, small in sort of absolute terms, but large in the context of the Canadian colonies and provinces. So in Creighton's research in those communities, in African Nova Scotian communities, the fact she was looking for material that had been created, composed within a folkloric tradition, but within Nova Scotia specifically, not brought from somewhere else. So that's a critical difference between the settler groups, though both were not indigenous in the sense we would use the term today, capital I indigenous, to Nova Scotia. They had both come from somewhere else. So that intrinsically disadvantaged that material sort of in this hierarchy of what was most representative, notwithstanding the fact that they had both come from somewhere else. And this was inverted yet again for the Mi'kmaq material. So in that case, Creighton collected both material that we would think of as sort of traditional material, like pre-contact sort of traditions, but also material that had been developed over the 300 and a bit year history at that point of Mi'kmaq Catholicism. So early on in the French colonial period, the Mi'kmaq aligned themselves with the Catholic Church, and in the time that had elapsed, it had become an important element of their culture. Of course, like, there are some negative implications, but in terms of the expressions that these Mi'kmaq sources offered Creighton to record and archive, the Catholic material was really quite a significant portion of that. It was important to them, important for them to to have preserved. Mm-hmm. But Creighton made an important distinction between these two different types of materials. Mm-hmm. She felt that one was more representative than the other, mm-hmm. even though both were traditions of considerable historical length and importance. Mm-hmm. So the distinctions between these groups are clearly racialized, essentially. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The fact that you can track this inversion of indigeneity and foreignness and authenticity as negotiated between those two poles mm-hmm. across these clear racial lines is essentially what I'm exploring in my dissertation. It hasn't been explored yet. And I think that it pushes back at the tendency for people who are commemorating Creighton's mm-hmm. work, which of course was important, mm-hmm. to say, well, she was a product of her time. These prejudices were in a different place now. Some even go as far as to argue that she was a sort of like proto-multiculturalist. but the fact alone that she collected across these groups, which supports the argument that she was sort of a multiculturalist, ignores the fact that she didn't sort of look equally upon all of this material. Some mm-hmm. was prioritized or the inverse according to various racialized ideas about what was authentically folkloric, what was folk culture in a Nova Scotian context. Mm-hmm. And it is no surprise, really, then, that the people who were racialized and minoritized in other contexts were also minoritized and racialized in this context mm-hmm. as well. So in part cultural history of the collection, mm-hmm. in part social history of discrimination within a Nova Scotian context. Right, so race and ethnicity, really quite important to the collection. I'm trying to get to the bottom of it.
No, it sounds, and I mean, your explanation of how Creighton could understand one group, say white settlers with a British heritage, as and their folk cultures as a connection back to British imperial history mm-hmm. as a sign of, therefore, Nova Scotianness and, yeah. and, you know, an idealized version of white British culture being yeah. what Nova Scotian culture is. And then mm-hmm. in contrast with African Nova Scotians, like you said, having the same history of movement, although, you know, different because of histories of enslavement, but yes. having same movement to a new place and new land mm-hmm. and then transporting music and adapting it to a new place, but yes. having that somehow discredit yes. their claim to being an authentic Nova Scotian.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
again, like how you elucidated very well, again, of course, Mi'kmaq being the original mm-hmm. inhabitants and caretakers of the land, having another kind of leap or change in logic to discredit their
yes.
adapted or interpretation of Catholicism,
yeah.
showing again that somehow they're not therefore mm-hmm. part of a Nova Scotian identity mm-hmm. or ideal in Creighton's mind. So
yes, absolutely.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense, and it's very interesting how you're pulling on these different sources and reading them critically, and
yes.
and again, like not discounting the importance of all of these recordings as a whole
yeah.
and the work of preserving folk culture,
mm-hmm.
but just looking with a critical eye and saying, okay, well, what does this tell us mm-hmm. about how different groups have been appreciated or
yeah.
Recognized over
yes.
time?
Yeah, an element of it is also taking seriously what Creighton did herself,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, to your point about not discounting the work,
mm-hmm.
Is in the tradition of feminist or women's history
mm-hmm.
to take seriously the work of these, what were often described by their male counterparts as women amateurs, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking the opposite position here and saying that what she did was very important. And in order to properly appreciate this, we need to think about it critically.
Mm-hmm.
And this is because it is so consequential, right?
Mm-hmm.
This work is essentially the definition of what folk culture is today in Nova Scotia, with all of its, you know, with these logics of racialized authenticity that
mm-hmm.
you still see playing out in a thousand different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really, my critique is not to put Creighton down or to just say that she was a racist, because that's not a very interesting argument on
mm-hmm.
its own. It's to understand how that kind of thinking, how that ideology works,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I think that's, I think it's sometimes people can lose that nuance, right?
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
a critical inquiry or deep look at something, and
yeah.
showing the way these logics unfold and work doesn't necessarily discredit other parts of,
no.
of work. I think
no.
I think sometimes that's a misconception about what critical scholarship can do and look like, but it's really
yeah.
trying to pull apart and tease out all of this nuance to
mm-hmm.
show what it can really tell us. And with that, What do you think studying folk music offers us today?
It's a good question. It has a bit of a reputation for being quaint and not very relevant. On the other hand, I think it offers us a way into discussing these, for example, the way that racialization works, the way that race and ethnicity and culture and nation are all deeply, deeply tied up in one another. In a medium that essentially everybody has an opinion on, you know, like we all have some stake, have some skin in the game of music, you know, like very few people will say, no, I don't listen to music. I don't like music. It's not for me. Music as a sort of cultural expression is fairly widely accessible. And yeah, like some folks might think that folk music is quaint. Others are very much invested in it. But on either side, it tells us a lot about how we view ourselves, right? Because of this sort of essential characteristic of the folk, you know, who that core of a culture represents or is represented in that. Yeah, it tells us a lot about who we think ourselves to be, the sort of stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, to quote Clifford Geertz, the anthropologist. I think there are also like a variety of historical reasons why folk music has been an important part of propagandizing for various causes on the left and on the right, and in our like current political climate, having a more critical view of what folk music is and means is an important tool in our toolkit, I think. But maybe on the most practical level, and I'm kind of circling back to the answer to the previous question, I think that studying folk music in this specific Nova Scotian context offers us another way to break down these, what are still today fairly clear, racially segregated lines within the society, within culture. It's, like folk music alone won't do it, but it is an important part of how Nova Scotians conceptualize themselves. So understanding the ways that that is a fundamentally racialized concept and then potentially working against it is kind of the activist bent in this kind of scholarship.
And it sounds like you're seeing your work, what it can do. So where do you see your work developing into the future?
Primarily, there were many other, especially women collectors like Creighton, that did similar work across the country around the same time. So initially this project was conceived of as a cohort study of a handful of these women.
Wow, that would be a lot.
Yeah. So as comprehensive and extensive as the Creighton collection is, tackling five of those, five of those would have been, well, it was a bit insane. So the current project is scaled down a bit. But in terms of future research, yes, I would like to explore how these other, again, primarily women collectors developed similar ideas on similar material in different parts of the country, how they worked together, communicated with each other. And ultimately, like, one of the most important and most influential folklorists of the 20th century in Canada was one of these women folklorists. She grew up in the Gaspé in Quebec, but became the chief of the folklore section, later division, and finally the Canadian Centre for Folk Culture Studies at the National Museum,
wow,
a federal research laboratory for folklore in the 1970s, that ahead of the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, which defined official multiculturalism as we know it, shifted the direction of folklore research within Canada to align with this sort of new configuration of ethnic and racial politics in Canada, like alongside, but even slightly before, the sort of official discourse. Her name was Carmen Hua. So like tracking that process at a federal institution is one of the projects I've got in the can. Like, I'd like to think more about how Scottish collectors coming through Nova Scotia, New Scotland, helped to define, or, you know, what the relationship was between Nova Scotian regionalism and Scottish cultural nationalism, which was also taking shape at the time, you know, pre-devolution. Yeah, so there's so much more work to be done in this field. There are some well-known, well-regarded studies already, but many, many more to be done. And I think in part that that comes from the fact that folklorists, anthropologists, ethnomusicologists tend not to be historical in their methodological approach, right? They're working in the field, interviewing people, doing oral history, but the sort of deep historical archival research is less the expectation, for example, for grad students. So yes, many more historical studies waiting to be done in this area. I'm hoping to tackle a slice off a little bit of that, but really, really lots and lots of work to be done. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds very exciting, and I'm hoping you'll be able to continue this research as you finish up your PhD, but also moving forward into the future. So Chris, it has been great chatting with you. Thank you for doing the show, and best of luck with the rest of the PhD and then all of these other projects that are on the horizon.
Well, thank you very much.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search GradChat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic, every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.